a preacher was, particular Sunday, he just felt like everything just rolled so wonderfully smooth. I mean, in fact, he didn't even, it's almost like the sermon went so well, in his mind at least, that he could actually step out of himself and kind of watch. It felt like that. It is so good. On the drive home, he asked his wife, "What do you think of the sermon today?" She really didn't say a whole lot. And he was kind of, they drove a little bit further, and then he mused, thinking to himself, "You know, I wonder how many great preachers there are in this world." And she didn't say anything immediately, so she thought for just a moment, kind of quiet. And he repeated himself, "I wonder how many great preachers there are in this world." And she spoke up to him, "One less than you think."
Ouch, right?
We're going to pick up in chapter 8 of Isaiah. Pick up verse 19. Now, we're still in a section of Isaiah that the historical situation is still the same as it was in chapter 7. You have Syria, or Aram, as it's called and translated in some Bibles, some translations. And you also have, in addition to that, you have the northern kingdom of Israel, or what's left of it, of trying to pressure Ahaz and Judah to join with them in a confederacy to resist the Assyrians. Ahaz was not so thought, he didn't think that was a good idea, basically. So they were going to remove him from his position, put in a puppet king, and then after that, had that what they thought would be a confederacy of those three different groups that would repel or at least stop Assyria from coming down any further into Israel. What had already happened, though, is a part of the northern kingdom had already been conquered, and the deportation of the population had already happened. They didn't take the hill country of Ephraim. That is still in the control of Israel, the northern kingdom. Remember, the 10 northern tribes, it's called Israel, or times Ephraim. And then the southern, there's two tribes called Judah. And it was Judah and also Benjamin were the two tribes in the south. So you had a divided nation. And the threat of the Assyrians was growing. And so that's kind of the historical situation that we're in. Always remember when you're reading, especially historical books or even prophecies in the Old Testament, and this also applies to the New Testament, there's a historical situation going on. Sometimes we read the Bible as if it was written exclusively to us. And we think of it in terms of our cultural situation. We have a tendency to do that. That's why in almost every generation you can begin identifying certain kind of characters that you might think is a fulfillment of prophecy, the end times prophecy. You can think that this person could be the Antichrist. In more recent years, more modern times, some began to believe that about Hitler. That Adolf Hitler could very well be the Antichrist. One, he persecuted the Jews. Secondly, though, amazingly, Germany did quite well in World War II for a period of time. I mean, the Blitz that affected Britain, France, it took France, Netherlands, you know, all that area, they really did look like a very formidable military. And they were. However, having said that, Hitler obviously was not the Antichrist. And there's been other people down through the ages. Henry Kissinger was a candidate for it for once, for a period of time. Certain presidents sometimes will end up being a candidate in the minds of some that he could possibly be the Antichrist or some other world leader, Putin or someone like that in more modern times. This goes back into the 1980, but Ronald Reagan was running for president. And sometimes Christians are the most gullible, silly people that you'll ever meet. And I don't mean that offensively, just as an observation. There was a rumor, circulating that Ronald Reagan could very well be the Antichrist. Because his name was Ronald Wilson Reagan.
You count up the letters of his name, and you end up with 666. And my aunt was very concerned about that, and she was talking to my mom on the phone and talking about the Antichrist, that the, you know, his name, the number of the letters would kind of line up. Could he possibly be the Antichrist? And then my mother told my aunt, well, Andy's name, Joseph Andrew DeWitt. Count the letters. So you can rest assured, I'm not the Antichrist. But it's the number of his name. So you have to be kind of careful about that, because we look at things through the lens of the time in which we live. And we can miss certain kind of important elements when we divorce or separate the Bible from its historical context. We don't mean to do it, but we can do it. It doesn't mean it's not relevant. It is relevant. But we need to be cautious about going too far with it, because we can make it say all kinds of things. When we begin looking at it in a setting unlike the setting that it was written in. Example, just one simple example, we'll move on. Well, when I would read, when I was growing up, or hear someone read, or a sermon on, or a teaching or something on the wilderness. Jesus went out in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 days, 40 nights, and he was tempted there by Satan. Now, when I've applied that to what I knew, I saw the wilderness as woods. I mean, just trees and hills and hollers and creeks and bluffs and rocks. That's what I thought. I thought about caves, because that was the geography of where I grew up, and that's where my mind went. Where Jesus went into the wilderness is nothing like that. Nothing like that. It's desert. It's desert. Now, there will be a green thing here and there, but it's nothing like I imagined by the idea of a wilderness. Or when the children of Israel in Exodus left and they went out into the wilderness and they spent 40 years in the wilderness. But it's not like I would have envisioned as a wilderness. That's just one simple example. So, how do you avoid that? Well, one method is that you have access to or own a good study Bible. Not all study Bibles are equal. They are constructed and developed according to a particular set of priorities. You've got to be careful about that, because some study Bibles will not help you a great deal, but others will help you a great deal. If you ever want to know more about that, I can tell you some suggestions on some decent ones to look at. You also can do this. Because of the advent of the internet, there is no shortage of reputable, decent websites that will help you navigate historical situations and that kind of thing. There's lots of them. There's a lot of them that are not good either, but there are many of them that are very helpful, and you can find good information, and most of it's free. You don't necessarily have to subscribe, and you can do that. And you can also get a pretty well inexpensive Bible dictionary or Bible encyclopedia. You usually can get those in one volume, and really they're not that expensive. That's just a few suggestions, so you don't get lost in trying. Because there's allusions, statements that are made that you kind of wonder about. I know I'm really deviating from what we're doing tonight, but for example, there was a practice of in the sacrificial system, especially when you're offering the sacrifice for the people, the high priest, there would be two goats. Two. And the one they'd be chosen by lot, and that was a way of I don't know what the lots exactly were, but you could take them and somehow they would reveal, you know, which one got the short straw, so to speak. And the one who got the short straw would actually be sacrificed. His throat cut, the blood caught, the body, the carcass burned, and the blood used as atoning sacrifice. The other goat was sent out into the wilderness. It was just driven away. And it was called, no kidding, the scapegoat. Because it symbolically carried the sins of the people. The other one covered the sins of the people, but this one would carry the sins of the people away. And it would go out into the desert, because you know what's in the desert? That's where the demons are. That's where Satan dwells. Out in the desert. And that's why they would do that. So, again, when you know a little bit about the historical situation, that kind of helps you understand things a little bit more. Okay. I want to back up to verse 19 of chapter 8 to deal with a particular indictment against God's people that Isaiah is pointing out. Now, I'm reading from the New King James Version, if you're wondering what one I'm reading from tonight. And when they say to you, seek those who are mediums and wizards, who whisper and mutter, should not a people seek their God? Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony? If they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. They will pass through the hard-pressed and hungry, and it shall happen when they are hungry that they will enlarge and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom and anguish, and they will be driven into darkness. It's a warning. It's a warning that the people had ignored. There's certain sources of information that's forbidden. Don't go there. You find it clearly demonstrated in Deuteronomy that you are not, there's certain kinds of methods of trying to gain information and guidance that you are to avoid. And they're serious. One is the practice of necromancy. Necromancy is a desire to contact departed spirits on behalf of the living. There's certain kinds of practices, seances, and that kind of thing that some people get kind of sucked into, and you're to avoid that. You're not to look for, you're not to try to contact the spiritual world realm on trying to find out what decision you need to make. The only one you are to consult is God and His Word. He is the one you consult. You do not consult these other sources. Goes further though. These mediums and wizards who whisper and mutter, don't go there. Go to the law and to the testimony. That is to what the Old Testament teaches. And talks about what will happen is they are going to inherit and bring onto themselves this hardship. And they're going to be thrown in and driven, as verse 22 tells us, they're going to be driven into darkness. There has and there will continue to be a fascination that a lot of people have with the dark arts. The attempts to contact the dead or to contact spirit guides, some source in order to gain information that will be beneficial to people here. Sometimes it is simple little things that some people just dismiss as being silly, but some people look at it quite serious. Let me think what I'm trying to say. Oh, the horoscope, for example. Your destiny's in the stars. Don't go there. You're trying to seek information from an illegitimate source. But you need to understand, too, why that prohibition exists. The prohibition exists because sometimes people will contact the spirit realm. And you need to be aware that in doing so, you are not going to get accurate information. You actually are going to end up getting information that's going to be destructive to both you and probably to others. It can be argued, and Oppenheimer agreed, the discovery of the atomic bomb, by some it has been suggested that it came via Satan. That's where the information came from and the know-how of developing the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer, he's the one, you may recognize the name from the movie, he's the one that was instrumental in developing the atomic bomb, and he said so. I'll give you another philosophy that has directly tied to the demonic realm. And by his own admission, the inspiration came from the demonic, and his name was Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. Marxism. Now the thing about both of those, the thing that kind of binds those two together, is this particular connecting device, so to speak, the connection. The connection is, both are destructive to humanity. And the demonic, the malevolent world of or realm of the spirit world looks to destroy people. What did Jesus say about Satan?
He was about the Lord.
Steal, kill, and destroy. That's what he's about. So I don't want to dip you out. The warning is don't look for information in illegitimate places. Now, some of you may be thinking, and you may not be thinking, but I need to deal with it probably. What about the Witch of Endor? King Saul banished all of the mediums, the spiritists, from Israel. And when he's getting toward the very end of his life, he disguises himself, and he goes to a place called Endor, and there's a spiritist there, and she's simply called, in the older translations, the Witch of Endor. Well, what Samuel is long dead, and what Saul wants, he wants her to contact Samuel, so Samuel could give him information about the battle that he was going to be in the very next day. Okay, you with me now? Mm-hmm. Now, indeed, Samuel showed up. So some would argue, well, there, the Bible talks about it actually happening. Well, there's a couple of interesting side notes. Number one, probably the most telling of this whole situation, is when Samuel did show up, it so scared the witch that she screamed. Which would kind of indicate that this isn't necessarily what always happens. But Samuel did show up, and he did give Saul information. But that is the only account that you find in Scripture where it occurs like that. And it seems like God gave a kind of a special dispensation, so to speak, to allow that to happen. But it doesn't. It shows something about the spiritual condition of Saul. That even though he banished all of these people, those are the people that he sought instead of God toward the end of his life. Okay, now we move into chapter 9. We won't get very far in chapter 9, I'm afraid. Or, I'm not afraid, it's a figure of speech. But we're picking at, really verse 1 should be a continuation of the previous chapter. The chapters and verses were added later. And those that were adding the chapters and verses sometimes didn't always nail it like we wish they would have. Because, remember, let's look at verse 22 to remind ourselves. And by the way, in the Hebrew Bible, verse 1 is connected to verse 22 of the previous chapter. It says, "Then they will look to the earth, and they will see trouble and darkness, gloom of anguish,
and they will be driven into darkness. Nevertheless, the gloom, see, we're still talking about the same thing. The gloom will not be upon her who is distressed. And when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterwards more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, and in Galilee of the Gentiles. Now, we read that, and we go, okay, what does that mean? This is where it's helpful to know a little bit about the contemporary situation that was at stake here. What's going on when the Assyrians came down and they conquered some of the area to the north of northern Israel? The land of Zebulun and Naphtali as a part of that. And afterward, more heavily, they oppressed. They oppressed the people who remained there. And then by the way of the sea and beyond the Jordan and in Galilee of the Gentiles. Three different regions are mentioned that were under Assyrian control. That's what's going on. And then even the issue of Galilee of the Gentiles. Okay? Now, Galilee, of course, you know basically where that is, up by the Sea of Galilee, and it stretches further north. That region was not only populated by Jews, it also was populated by Gentiles, non-Jewish people. Especially if you went on the east side of the Dead Sea. That was the Decapolis, the 10 cities, and they were pagan. That's where you find hogs, pigs, is on that side, on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, over there. So you have that area of the Gentiles. And that, so the way of the sea, that is the trade route that comes down out of what we'd call Iraq, and that, those areas, Syria, comes down into Israel. And then it deviates, comes down through around by the Sea of Galilee, then it goes over toward the Mediterranean, and it goes along the shore, really, of the Mediterranean Sea. It's a trade route, is what it was. And then, of course, Galilee of the Gentiles was an area that was oppressed by the Assyrians. And what the Assyrians would do, and what most of these ancient empires would do, they would conquer. And they had certain methodologies. They would conquer, and then they would, usually, like the Assyrians, for example, they would displace people. So they come in and they'd take people from one region and move them to another region. And in moving them to another region, you kind of break the nationalistic spirit. And then they would import other people to that area. Did you ever wonder where Samaritans came from? This is where they came from. There were Jews that were left in the land, the poorest of the poor. And the least influential of them, not leaders, but just common everyday folk, they were left there. And they also were brought other people displaced from other regions of their empire that they conquered, and they would settle them there. The two groups intermarried. And that's why the Jews didn't like the half-breeds, the Samaritans, and vice versa. Okay? So that's what's going on. Now, verse 2 takes a turn. This is bad. Things are bad. The people are rebellious. He's going to get back to this rebellion of the people again in a moment. But the people are rebelling against God. They're in total, total rebellion. But it's not over yet. It's not done. God's not through. You will find over and over, even in those times of nationalistic crisis, God will save for himself a remnant of his people. That's why you have Jews today. You go back, how many Assyrians are around today? How about Babylonians? How about Jebusites? Amorites? Those people have been lost in antiquity, in the past. They've been absorbed into other people groups. But you still have Jews. Since God has always saved himself a remnant. Okay, having said that, verse 2. Here's where the glimmer of hope comes in the next number of verses, at least through verse 7. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. There is this contrast between what we find in verse 22, they're driven into darkness, and the people in the gloom of verse 1 of chapter 9. But now you have this. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. What we have here is Isaiah reaching back into chapter 7 and verse 14. The virgin will conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel. He's reaching back to that Emmanuel promise, and he's pulling it forward to this chapter 9. And this light, this people who have previously walked in darkness, now have a great light. They've seen a great light. And those who dwell in the land of the shadow of death, you feel the desperation there? The pressure of just surviving? You're in the shadow of death. And upon them a light has shined. Verse 3, you have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. Are you starting to feel the contrast of the hopelessness of walking in darkness and gloom, in living in the shadow of death, the desperation there? But now you have now you have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. And they rejoice before you according to the joy of a harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. Now those are images, metaphors that are helpful. If you live in an agricultural culture, when your survival depends on your harvest, when you have a great harvest, what kind of a feeling are people going to have? Joy! We have an abundant harvest. We've got food. We're going to survive. We're not going to starve. We're not going to scrounge around. We have what we need. And according to the joy of the harvest, and as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. Another figure of speech. One of the occurrences that would happen too frequently in the ancient world would be to fight. You'd have to battle. A great joy for a soldier is the battle is over, and you've won. Now you get to divide the enemy's stuff. It's now yours. And there's great joy in that, because the fighting is over. And now it is a celebration time. For you have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor. The idea, again, of the oppression of an enemy. They're pressuring you. They've been living under the pressure of, okay, you've had a good crop. The Assyrians are going to come and say, I'm going to take your crop. I'm taking it for us. Now that oppression is broken. The idea of a yoke put on your neck. You're controlled by them. You're oppressed by them. That's going to be broken. Verse 5. For every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and the garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of the fire. What's left over after a battle will be done away with. The blood-soaked garments, those things will be disposed of. So you have a positive look, but we're not done yet. Now we get to Christmas card time. Okay? This is, again, one of the passages that you see. Now, here's for sure where you can see that he's going back to chapter 7, verse 14. He's getting a hold of it and he's pulling it in here. For unto us a child is born. Okay. But not just a child. Unto us a son is given. So you have this child, but it's not just a child, it's a son. The ancient world it's not that much different than sometimes in some of our own cultures. The majority, a lot of couples look forward to the birth of a son. Now, it's not that a daughter is not important, but in the ancient world, it's the son that's important. The daughters, I mean, I didn't say they didn't love their daughters and that kind of thing, but it wasn't looked upon like a son being born. That's when it was real joyous, when a son was born. Somebody who's carrying on the family lineage. A woman will marry, but then she bears the name of her husband. But a young man will carry the family name, you see. So that was important to people then, and to some even now. Go further. And the government will be upon his shoulder. Now that sounds, we normally don't think about that, but can you imagine the weight of the government being upon this person? This person's going to shoulder the weight of the government. But there's more to this individual than just simply a king that's going to be responsible for a government. You'll notice there's going to be descriptions given of him. Each one of these couplets are going to tell us something very specific about this one individual. He's going to be first wonderful counselor. So we'll talk about his wisdom. And sometimes it's divided up wonderful, comma, counselor. But most likely it's the two are connected together. A wonderful counselor. His wisdom is going to be unmatched. Next thing about him is mighty God. That is also a very important statement. El Gibber. Mighty God. You don't say that about a man that's only a man. You might say wonderful counselor, you've got Solomon, right? You can think about him in the past. But now, you've got mighty God. Tells us something far more amazing about this particular individual. Everlasting Father. That too is very, very important. Everlasting Father. The idea being communicated there is he's the father of eternity. Now I want you to think about this. Think about these terms and what they're telling us. One, his wisdom. Two, his power. Three, when you talk about everlasting father, he is forever, forever. And you connect two things, the everlasting, the eternal aspect, but also the fatherliness of this person. And then, of course, he's finally referred to as, in these couplets, Prince of Peace. Not just a prince, but a Prince of Peace. This verse, verse 6, is an incredible verse about the identity that we know will later apply to the Lord Jesus himself. It cannot fit anyone else. There is no one else. Getting even more specific. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. And the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. In other words, God stamps his approval on this, and he's going to make sure it is done. When you look at, you think about that, look at, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, he's going to establish justice and judgment from that time forever and forevermore. You can see what we're doing here. I want to do something. And I'm going to do this in a way I hope it illustrates. And Lynn can correct me if I get it wrong. Okay. You may be wondering, should I ever let Lynn correct me? But Lynn is going to be an expert here where I'm not. Okay, you're going to write me a letter. Okay, very good. I'm glad you're going to write me a letter. When that letter is going to be delivered to me, say you mail it from, you have to be vacationing in Georgia, picking some peaches or something down there, then you send me a note in the mail. And how is that letter going to get to me? Well, the first important bit of information on your envelope is going to be what? The zip code. Not my street address. There may be a whole bunch of Woodland Drives in the United States of America. But what's going to happen is that zip code is going to bring that letter, hopefully, to a geographic area. Okay, that's good. So you look at the zip code, and then you go next. You're kind of working your way backwards. You get, you know, okay, which city? Now, there's some places where a zip code will cover more than just one town. It will spread out. Like where I grew up 13 miles north of Forsyth, Missouri. But our zip code was Forsyth's zip code, 65653. So it wasn't, it would get there in that region, but that's not good enough. You've got to go now to a street address or an address. Next bit of information that's important is going to be, in the letter you're sending me from Georgia is going to be my street. You got the town. Zip code brought it to the right geographic area, to the town. Then, now you're going to move it from there to the street. Now, on Woodland Drive, there are several houses. I don't know how many, but there's a bunch of houses. So just bringing the letter to Woodland Drive is not enough. Right? Now you've got to have a number. Which house is it? Well, you need 141. And then you get the right house. Ah, but you're not done yet. At 141, there might be other people living there. So it's traveled to the right place. This is all going to make sense later, okay? Trust me. All right, now we get to the place. Now it's like we still get my mother-in-law's mail because she lived with us for a year. We still get her mail. We've told these places, we've done the change of address. We still get her mail. So anyway, so you need to go not just to that house. It's supposed to go to a particular person who lives in that house. You follow that. All right, now you're ready for it. God approaches, calls Abraham. Abraham, you're going to have a son of the promise. I know that you're an old man. I know that your wife's an old woman, and you have no children. She's barren. I know all that. However, you're going to have a son. 25 years passes. That son hasn't been born yet. So, about 13 years before that son is born, Sarah says, you know, God's dragging his feet here. I'm going to use my maid as a surrogate. She will have your son, and I'll just call him mine. Well, so Abraham says, hey, sounds like a good deal to me. So he has a son. It doesn't go well. It just doesn't go well. Hagar has a son. Eventually, her son, Ishmael, and Hagar are expelled. They have to leave. The son is born,
Okay, so you got Isaac. Now, Abraham later, after the death, now he's got Ishmael as a son. So he's got two sons. But then later he marries a woman named Keturah and has five more sons. So Abraham has actually seven sons. Seven, but only one is son of the promise. There's one zip code, the right zip code. So Isaac, the son, he has two sons. So, but it's not the oldest son. It's not Esau. It's Jacob. Not just one, but it's Jacob. So Jacob is, don't you see how specific God is in doing this? It's just like getting a letter to some degree. So Jacob is the son, not the other sons of Abraham, not his brother Esau, now just Jacob. Well, Jacob has how many? 12 sons. Woo-wee! Now but see, it's not just any son of Jacob. It's only one son of Jacob. Number three, his name is Judah. Okay? Now Judah. So you eliminate the other 11 sons and you come to just Judah. It's going to be through Judah that this one's going to come. But not just any descendant of Judah. It's going to be one of the twins that's born to him. Again, 50% are going to be eliminated. It's only one specific son. And then we go down a little bit further, and then you find there's a Moabite in there named Ruth. Ruth has a child by Boaz. And that child has a child. And his name is Obed. Obed has a son, probably many sons, but one son in particular, Jesse. Jesse has seven sons. But you have to have only one son through whom this promise is going to be carried. And it's going to be the youngest son, not the oldest son, but the youngest son. So six are going to be, no, not their lineage, but the youngest son, David. David had many sons. One, the most well-known son, was one named Solomon. There's a problem, though. Most of Solomon's lineage, Ahaz is one of Solomon's descendants. Okay? But when you get to, I think it's Zechariah, we discover, I have to look this up to be sure, but that line of Solomon is cursed. So the possibility of David's son Solomon being the son through whom this Messiah would eventually come comes to an end. We got a problem. Oh, no, we don't have a problem. Now, Joseph in the New Testament, he is a descendant of Solomon. Mary is not. Mary is a descendant of a different son of David, a son named Nathan, not Solomon. So the line of Nathan isn't cursed. He's still a descendant of, if you want to go back up, he's still the right, he's a descendant of David, but he is not a descendant of Solomon. And Mary is, if you look in Luke chapter 3, you'll see this. You'll see that indeed it is Nathan who is the ancestor to Mary. Now, you need to know something about Jewish reckoning. If a Jewish woman has a son, he's Jewish. It's not based on the father, it's the mother. That may sound odd to you, because normally we think everything's associated with the father. No, it's the mother. So Jesus has no earthly father. It's not Joseph. Because the lineage can't be Joseph, it has to be Mary. Because Mary is his mother, she gave birth to the Lord, but Joseph is not the biological father You follow what I'm saying? Now, I give you that, and I could draw it out and make more sense to you if I take an hour, hour and a half to do that with you. But what I'm pointing out by this is, you see how what you see is, you see God's hand all through the Old Testament. God directing things. There's things that happen. For example, there's the Assyrian Empire, followed by the Babylonian Empire. During the Babylonian Empire, the Judah is carried off into captivity. They fall to the Babylonians. Following the Babylonians comes the Medo-Persian Empire. Medo-Persian Empire is different because they have a different philosophy. Hey, you all have been here for 70 years. If you want to go back to your homeland, go. Bless you. As a matter of fact, you know, 200 or 300 years before it happens, you're going to later Isaiah is going to call the man by name. His name is Cyrus. That he is going to be the one to issue the edict. In 444 BC, he gave the edict for the Jews to return to Jerusalem if they so chose, and many of them did. Ezra and Nehemiah, you following some of these folks? Okay. And through all of that, God is superintending all of this. Because every single time, God preserved the right people. And the Jews were really particular about this. You know, I didn't do this, and I don't think any of y'all did this either. But, you know, I had a little boy born. And I tell him, your grandfather's name is so-and-so. Your great-grandfather's name is so-and-so. Your great-great-grandfather's name is so-and-so. Your great-great-great-grandfather's name is... You'd memorize that. You memorized your lineage. You memorized your ancestors. Do you know your great-grandparents' names? Some do, but not everybody does. And in these days, you probably struggle even with sometimes grandparents because you may have a kid that may have, you know, eight pairs of grandparents or more with all the stuff. That, so what I'm saying by that is God superintends all of this. So
even when it looks like pretty bleak, it's not. It's not. Oh, I need to do verse 7. We did that, really. And it concludes with the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. We move into verses 8 and through 21. And I'm going to give you a quick summary since our time is almost gone. The summary is there is a reoccurring phrase that kind of gets our attention, and it should get our attention, about what's going on in Ephraim and Samaria. Remember, those two places, even though right now they are causing Judah problems, they're going to cease. They're under God's hand of judgment. They're not going to continue, and they're going to collapse. And there's this reoccurring phrase you see in verse 12. For all his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. God is still judging. Drop a little bit further into verse 17. For all his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And then, of course, verse 21. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. That happens three times. The certainty of the judgment of the northern area, northern of Israel, Ephraim, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, that area, and also Syria, north on further north, Aram or Syria, that the judgment is God's judging them. Why is he doing that? Well, he's doing that because they are in abject rebellion against God, and they refuse to repent. That's why. Could God divert the judgment if the people would respond? Yeah. A little bit later, it's going to be several chapters from now,
We're going to meet Hezekiah. And we'll talk about Hezekiah's tunnel. We're going to talk about Hezekiah's preparation because of the invasion that he knows is coming of the Assyrians. The Assyrians are going to show up. They're going to come to his emissaries, Sennacherib, the king, his emissaries are going to come and they're going to stand just outside of the wall of Jerusalem and they're going to speak Hebrew. And they're going to tell the people, everyone who can hear them shouting this out, don't let Hezekiah deceive you. Nobody can withstand the army of Nebuchadnezzar. No one can. Not Nebuchadnezzar, Sennacherib. Excuse me. I jumped ahead too far. It's hopeless. You might as well give up now. And Hezekiah had given orders. Don't say a word to them. Well, not only did they come and say it, they also brought a letter. You know, it's time to surrender. Hezekiah signed on the bottom line. So what Hezekiah does, he takes that, and Isaiah is there to help him. But he takes that letter, and he takes it into the temple, and he lays it out, he opens it up. He says, God, look what these people are saying. And he begs God, he pleads with God, he prays to God for deliverance. Well, you can imagine everyone in Jerusalem is probably pretty tense. Assyrians are not very kind. They like to kill. They enjoy it. And they're good at it. So even if they surrender, there's going to be a bloodbath. And if they don't surrender, there's going to be a bloodbath. So, what do you do? Other areas have already succumbed. Lachish has fallen to the Assyrians. And then the next day, there's a couple of lepers sauntering around out there. They come up to the gate and said, we just saw the most doggone thing. The Assyrian camp, they're all dead. They're all dead. There's all kinds of good stuff laying there you can pick up and just take. You see what happened, what we know happened, because the scripture tells us, God sent an angel. And that night, killed 185,000. Count them. 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. What does Sennacherib do? Well, he hightails it back. He's lost his army. He's done. What I'm saying, though, Judah gets a reprieve. But it doesn't stay that way because they will once again fall into sin and abject rebellion against God. Comments or questions? Additions? When people become prideful, when people become arrogant and hard-hearted and the scripture stiff-necked, when people will not repent, look out. God is merciful. He gives reprieves. He gives extensions. But you got to surrender to Him. Mm-hmm. Got to surrender. All right, free to go.